Hello and welcome listeners to Women Leading Change. This is a podcast series launched by the Sahel and West Africa Club, SWAC Secretariat, at the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. Here, we tell the stories of inspiring women leading change as civil society actors, activists, authors, health and humanitarian workers, politicians, traders and business leaders in West Africa. I am your host, Dr. Lena Coney Hoffman, and in this series, you will hear from transformative change makers who are dedicated to promoting gender equality and empowering women across West Africa. These conversations help us better connect SWAC's evidence-based analysis with civil society advocacy and action. They also point to evidence gaps as well as new directions for possible future work. Joining me today is our guest, Chioma Agwebu. Chioma is the Executive Director of TechHa NG and leads the State of Emergency GBV Movement, a coalition igniting citizens to advocate for an urgent, comprehensive, and sustainable response to sex and gender-based violence. Chioma is an NPhil candidate in development communication and believes in using technology to advance women and girls. Welcome, Chioma. It is a pleasure to have you.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
So I want to begin with your story of advocacy, which I understand goes back to 2008. Gender issues and women's protection have been cross-cutting themes across your 15 years of advocacy and involvement in some very powerful campaigns. SWAC's 2018 paper on gender equality in West African social institutions draws on the OECD's Social Institutions and Gender Index SIGI analysis. And this work highlights the persistent and numerous ways discriminatory laws and social practices restrict women in West Africa. Nigeria is the region's biggest economy, and it features a lot in this analysis. It is even placed in the category of 8 countries with very high levels of discrimination against women. I'll have to add that in the 2023 update of the index, Nigeria shows some modest improvements. But I'd like to hear your thoughts, Chioma, of this on the state of sexual and gender-based violence in Nigeria. What do you think is broken and which actors are not engaging or not getting it?
Thank you very much. That's a very big question. And I guess I'll start by raising an eyebrow for the modest improvement you mentioned. When you think about the actual response and prevention of sexual and gender-based violence in Nigeria, I'm not sure we have moved the needle much. Have we done a number of launches, you know, launching this dashboard here, launching that response there, conducting advocacy visits here and there? Of course, we've done all of those types of things. Have we engaged several groups, whether it's men's groups, women's groups, etc.? Yes. But as far as protection, and not just the letter protection, the spirit of the word protection, I'm not sure that we have made what you have tagged as modest improvement. And I say this because in 2020, I did convene the State of Emergency GBV Movement. And this is because, you know, because of the lockdowns during COVID, sexual violence, gender-based violence had escalated exponentially. As a matter of fact, UN Women had done a report calling gender-based violence the shadow pandemic. And we launched this movement on the 3rd of June, 2020. By the 5th of June, we were on the streets campaigning, etc. By the 12th of June, the federal government of Nigeria declared a state of emergency on sexual and gender-based violence. So you would say, you know, swift progress.
Yeah.
However, The case that actually tipped us over the edge and led us into that protest was the sexual assault and eventual death of a young woman in Edo State who had gone to church to read during the pandemic. She was raped and hit over the head with an extinguisher, a fire extinguisher, and she died from her injuries a few days later. Us hearing about her death, birthed the movement. This is 2023, and the people who were arrested and, you know, put in jail for that crime escaped during the Edo State jailbreak. Other cases that we have engaged with very closely over the past couple of years, we haven't seen any justice. So when we say we have made modest improvements, I can count on my fingers and on my toes the cases of young men, young women that are crying for justice, that are crying for some sort of commensurate and swift response that then serves as a deterrent for other would-be perpetrators of sexual and gender-based violence.
Those are very sobering points of view. And as you said, it is one thing to have the letter of the law.
Yes.
But in terms of the spirit of the implementation of this law and sufficient deterrence across social institutions, across government agencies and so on, being actually active and partnering, the modest improvements that the index suggests don't really hold well in light of scrutiny, the scrutiny that you've placed them under. And it is really just very harrowing to listen to the personal experiences you have had of speaking with victims and how little protections are in place for these victims. So there is obviously an evidence gap there.
Yes.
I don't know if there are any other evidence gaps you'd like to identify in terms of the kinds of support that victims of SGBV get that don't get highlighted in a lot of these global indexes that we see.
I think before you look at, you know, the response to gender-based violence in any country, you have to think about the way the country looks at its women and how it views its girls. We've seen legislators say that if they pass the Gender and Equal Opportunities Bill, women will become lesbians and start having abortions. We belong to a country where there are social and, you know, there's social discriminatory practices, even business discriminatory practices against women. It's tough to ascribe any form of seriousness or urgency to these matters. As a matter of fact, the sexual harassment bill was passed, I think, last year or the year before. And this year, we had some groups going to the National Assembly to say, you know what, we need to expand the laws that we have to cover other forms of sexual violence in universities. And the message, you know, the informal message we got back from the National Assembly was, well, we've just passed an online harassment bill. Are we going to only just be passing bills for women? Sometimes you talk about the Gender and Equal Opportunities Bill and then you hear things like, oh, you people want to run men out of this country. That is, this is where your evidence gap starts from. The fact that this issue cannot be given, cannot be ascribed the seriousness that it deserves. So when you talk about evidence, I am constrained to speak only to the evidence because we have to think about the environment from which this evidence will be produced. And that is the environment that is lacking. So we start from perception. The other thing I'll say is there's a lot more focus on advocacy than there is on actual response. And this perhaps is the reason why TechHER and Education as a Vaccine, EVA, are piloting something called an Emergency Response Fund. This Emergency Response Fund provides immediate, as soon as 24 hours from when we approve the request, for people who have suffered any form of violence. There is no emergency response mechanism to receive this incident. So when we tell people report, what are we reporting for? What's going to happen? The final thing is, I would say, the closing of the loop when someone makes a report. I remember that in 2019, TechHER, the State of Emergency GBV, and a number of other partners convened a meeting, including Amnesty International and a number of international donors. And we said, what happens when a person reports rape, for instance, from the day they report to the day the perpetrator is jailed. And we brought all of those people into the room, from lawyers to the police, security forces, etc. Because NAPTIP, for instance, has an emergency line. NAPTIP is the agency in charge of the prohibition of trafficking in persons. But when you send a message to their short code, what happens? Who receives that message? Who calls you? Who arranges the arrest of the perpetrator? Who prosecutes, etc.? There's so many points at which the ball drops. And so all you have is someone has reported, but the connecting dots are faulty. Right. So I would say that that's another gap that needs to be closed. Nigeria is a country of 200 million plus people. If one case has taken us 2 months to get to the point where the perpetrator has been invited to make a statement, what is the hope for justice for survivors of sexual and gender-based violence?
It's really difficult to answer that question. It is really concerning that it is really so hard to answer the questions around access to justice, the speediness of the judicial process. It is impossible to think about the numbers of victims. This is beyond falling through the cracks. This is a chasm. Tens of thousands or even more victims are falling through, and the system is basically failing so many people. And I really do take on board and like to underscore the points you make about not just evidence, but looking at the environment, perception, and the real question there about how a society views its women. It's a really important question for us to think about along the lines of advocacy, which you say, you know, we are doing so much more on advocacy, but in terms of actual response, that is where the rubber hits the road, or should hit the road, and that is where there is so much in terms of resources, in terms of real action, that is lacking. And this, of course, should drive us to interrogating how we're gathering evidence around these issues and who this evidence is for. I do want to ask you the next question, and it's to do with violence against women, particularly in cases of conflict. Nigeria, again, is at the epicenter of all types of violence in the region, including violence against women. Of all the violent acts against women in West Africa, 87% of them occur in Nigeria. And we know that this is largely due to three major ongoing conflicts affecting Nigeria. And these conflicts are in the Niger Delta region, the Middle Belt, and the Lake Chad Basin region. You lead a women's rights NGO, and we know women-centered organizations and platforms are key for development, stability. You are doing a lot in the advocacy space and also driving, pushing for sustainable responses. How effectively do you think ODA is partnering and supporting women rights organizations like Tekha NG?
Thank you. That's an interesting question. And what I would say to this is, I think there's a lot more opportunities for international partners to be granular in their response. And this is why, so I sit on the board of Plan International Nigeria. And one of the things I appreciate about Plan International Nigeria is the fact that they've done quite a bit of reflection on how they engage, because they do a lot of humanitarian work with, you know, for women and girls. They've done a lot of reflection on how they engage in some of these conflict areas. And they are asking, you know, very hard questions on their engagement with local organizations, their engagement with communities, and they continue to realign, or would I say redirect their funding or redirect their programming along these lines. I would say, unfortunately, that the same is not the case for a good number of international organizations who come to Nigeria with a plan of what they want to do, and then start to implement that plan, sometimes without enough consultation with the people within the areas that they have come to work. So what you have is, again, we come back to fancy reports, we come back to, well-budgeted, well-implemented programs, but programs that don't have as much impact as they could have. There's something Plan International Nigeria did, which I really, really respect. They brought young people from these vulnerable communities onto something called, it's kind of like a young girls council, so that in addition to the voices of people who have gone to school, people with the fancy degrees, people from the international NGOs, you have people from within the communities who can say, no, I don't want biscuit, I want bread, or I don't want water, I want a Coke. And I think this is a type of human-centered design that we should start thinking about as we transition from IDP camps back into communities, or as we continue to provide services in the Northeast. I would also say that we need to think about skill. Yes, a number of people in these areas are uneducated, but we should think about leapfrogging. And that means we're not just teaching them ABCs, we're teaching them to use computers, we're teaching them digital skills, so that they too can leapfrog. And I bet you we are leapfrogging for hundreds and hundreds of miles because of all that's been lost, not just physically, infrastructurally, but also time. So there's quite a bit of leapfrogging to be done. And the only route to that is technology, which is not being employed as widely as one would expect. So that's what I'd say. We have done work in the Northeast as the state of emergency GBV movement, but not as techer. And that means we've worked more around sexual and gender-based violence than we have as, a technology company. But, this is something that we would be open to. But I'm a big believer in people-centered design, and so we would have to engage with them to ask them what they want. TechCare itself is hinged on asking women, what do you want to learn? It's one of our cardinal questions, because if there's no investment from the people, we'll all be wasting our time.
That is indeed correct. Asking women what they want, paying attention to what women want, being human-centered throughout. I like the points you make about a constant engagement with the communities that you would like to impact, and also the point about evidence in regards to impact. That those are real questions that we do need to ask when we're talking about ODA. And being more granular. And thank you for opening up that door to international partners, that there are opportunities and there are lessons and approaches that you've highlighted in the work that you do with Plan and with TECA, for being more granular, being more engaged, and more community and human-centered and focused. I'd like to bring us to our final question for this episode. Many countries in the region face challenges in data collection, analysis, and dissemination. This holds true particularly for gender disaggregated data. What role do you think local women's rights organizations can play in helping to improve gender statistics and close gender data gaps?
Thank you. This is a good question, and it speaks to the heart of what we've talked about, the numbers that we gather and how the numbers are useful for planning and just for implementation. One of the things that local women's rights organizations can do, and it is expensive, right? Data collection is expensive. I would say that if we worked together, and I'm in Abuja and I'm gathering numbers in Abuja, someone else is gathering in Edo State, someone else is gathering in Kogi State, Bauchi State, Anambra, whatever, we are able to then say, across this number of states, we have gathered this amount of data, as opposed to 12 organizations in Abuja gathering 12 chunks of data from the same Abuja without engagement with the others. And I guess even for our emergency response fund, we wanted to use the disbursement of funds as a data collection tool, which is why we have excluded Lagos and Abuja from the states that can apply. We will only take cases from Lagos and Abuja on very, you know, stringent grounds. But we want to hear from other states. So from Katsina, we've gotten cases from Katsina, from Bauchi, from Kaduna, from Ondo State, from Ogun. And that gives us the body of data that we typically don't get. So when we say we receive, I don't know, 2 cases a day or 1 million cases a day, we are able to disaggregate based on the states that these cases are coming from, you know, without just saying, oh, Lagos and Abuja to the detriment of the other states. So that's the first thing, working together to expand our data collection. I would say the second thing is thinking about sustainability. And I say this because even Tekka, we have struggled with sustainability in the past, and that has meant that sometimes we do as we are told because we want to remain in line for funding. But we are now reorganizing our work in such a way that the same things, also because of the type of registration that we have, we are registered as a social enterprise. So we are reorganizing our work in such a way that we are also able to seek sources of funding outside grants. And that will help our sustainability. That way, we are able to reject numbers, instructions, or things that we are not comfortable with, because we know that we will not, you know, we will not struggle because we have said no. So I would say some sort of pursuance of sustainability slash a measure of independence will be helpful so that we're able to do this. The final thing that I will say is we have to call out government more. You know, we have to actually call out the government a lot more. And I'm not going to be naive and say it doesn't have its consequences, whether for, you know, online, physical, even mental security. But again, there's, you know, there's strength in numbers. And if 15 of us co-sign a statement calling out a set of statistics that the government has put out, we are less likely to face censure than if one organization put it out by themselves, standing alone.
Those are really important takeaways and points to put forward. And it makes me really think about the extent to which any of the evidence, you know, even concerning evidence of the kinds of discrimination, harms and barriers that women face, to what extent it plays a role in policy discourse and dialogue. Because even the evidence in and of itself as poorly gender disaggregated as it often is, speaks to very concerning dynamics. But these don't inform, as you say, the ways in which policymakers think about the issues, particularly women's issues. I really do appreciate your time, Choma, on this call. Thank you so much for your insights. I am still stuck with the question you raised in the beginning, because I think it's a question that ran through my mind the entire time we were speaking about what we think about women. So the perception of women in our evidence, in policy dialogue, in impact assessments. We do need to be asking those questions for ourselves, data collectors, analysts, but interrogating governments and international partners. If you do want to make impact, if you want your evidence to actually play a role in changing people's fortunes and having an impact in people's lives, we have to ask ourselves a lot of these really hard questions. I hope you enjoyed this episode. You're welcome to explore the entire series on women leading change, women such as Choma, by the OECD Sahel and West Africa Club. So till next time.